Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. Christians are suffering mass martyrdom. That's the opinion of the Archbishop of Canterbury, who spoke out this week against the slaughter of Christians in the Muslim world. So is he right? And if so, why is the West so unwilling to do anything about it? Also, why the Renaissance wasn't nearly as enlightened as we imagine, but instead was an age of disease, war, and prejudice. I'm joined in the studio by Telegraph columnist and Spectator editor Fraser Nelson, by the Catholic Herald blogger Father Alexander Lucy Smith, and by the historian Dr. Alexander Lee. A recent bomb attack at a church in Peshawar, Pakistan, claimed the lives of 85 people and left 200 with injuries. Last month, around 100 Christian sites were attacked amid the turmoil in Egypt, with 42 churches burned to the ground. And Christians are undergoing a mass exodus from Syria, where they're being targeted by Islamist mobs. The takeaway is obvious. Christians are being targeted and persecuted because of their faith. But the West seems reluctant to put two and two together. And Justin Welby's claim that the victims are martyrs evokes a language that we're rather unused to hearing, maybe even uncomfortable about. Decades of political correctness and liberalism have taught us that Christians are oppressors, and we're the ones who oppress others. But now it would seem to be the other way around, and very few politicians are prepared to talk about it. Let's start by unpackaging why Christians are under such stresses. Fraser Nelson, in the early 20th century, Christians made up about 20% of the population in the Middle East. Now it's just 5% and falling. What's happened in that time?
What's happened is religious cleansing. It might sound like a dramatic phrase, but it's one that Nicolas Sarkozy used when he was French president, because he called out the problem in a way that our politicians in Britain still are fearful of doing. You are seeing communities that have lived together peacefully for generations finding tension sown between them, usually by radical Islamists who want a power play. Now, in the old days, the Islamists would have, you know, if you wanted power, you deposed the government or something like that. You set new laws, you change parliaments. But what's happening now, as we saw in Basra, is you can control a local area by putting on it an extreme version of Islamism, taking control of civil society and then kicking out the non-believers, and also declaring some kind of religious war on the Christians of Iraq, for example, who are now a fraction of their former community in what was once the land of Abraham. So we are seeing sectarianism being used, a new form of warfare. It's a warfare we're not used to seeing, but nonetheless it's a warfare which is putting, which is set in place, an exodus of truly biblical proportions happening right in front of our eyes.
Something I would take away from that is the implication that nationalist governments that came before, the Ba'athist governments, were somewhat better for religious minorities than those that are being established now.
That's the irony. I mean, Bashar Assad is a complete tyrant, but he chose his victims equally, whether they wore the cross, the niqab, or the skull cap. He didn't really mind. The same with Saddam Hussein. He had a Catholic deputy, Tariq Aziz. So these secular dictators, they were never really interested in using religion as a tool of oppression. In fact, their enemies tended to be the Islamist insurgents, and they wanted to tone all that down. What has happened is that there's been a power vacuum in the region, partly inspired, of course, by the West intervention in Iraq. And into that vacuum, you found the strong horse of radical Islamism, which is beginning to express its power over society by trying to sow religious divisions in the same way that we saw them in the former Yugoslavia.
Father Lucy Smith, what's your reading of what's happened?
Well, I've been to Aleppo. I've met Christians from the Middle East. One of the things about the Christians in places like Syria, Iraq, and Egypt is they tend to be well-educated, middle class. They tend to be things like dentists and doctors and so on. And they tend to be predominantly urban. And they are resented by many of the Muslim population because they seem to be more successful than them. And they're also resented, particularly in Syria, because they were protected for many years by Bashar al-Assad. Bashar al-Assad ran Syria using a network of alliances between the various minorities, his own Alawite minority and, of course, the Shiite minority, and against the Sunni majority. What we're seeing now is the Sunni awakening, the idea that the Sunnis will now try and take over Syria, and they will punish these people who, for so long, have been living what they think have been comfortable lives, benefiting from the dictatorship. And there is some truth in that, sadly.
There is some truth in the fact that Christians have had
And also
an
in
easier
Egypt,
ride.
President Mubarak did protect the Christian minority in Egypt. There's no doubt about that.
Does that mean they were in some sense collaborating with the regime, or simply that they were politically useful to it?
Collaborating with the regime is an ugly word, but yes. I mean, I know quite a few Christians from Mosul, and they were all members of the Ba'ath Party, though they didn't talk about it. Because, after all, the Ba'ath Party was founded by a Christian Arab, don't forget, the Party of Arab Resurrection. It's a secular party. I can't remember his name. You probably know it, as you're a historian, Michel somebody or another. He was later converted to Islam after his death and buried in a mosque. Right. But he was a Christian.
I don't recall his name, but I remember that yes. Tariq Aziz was the foreign secretary.
Tariq Aziz's minister. Real name is not Tariq Aziz, it's Michel something something. Right. He never went to mass, but his wife was regular in church.
Where are those people going to now, those people
America.
Who are undergoing?
Right. They all go to a place called Glendale in California.
They're all going to the same place?
Yes. I mean, if you go to Glendale in California and you get on a bus, it's full of people speaking Arabic or speaking Armenian. The first lot to go to Glendale left as soon as the Shah fell in 1979, and the Christians from Iran decided they did not want to live under a Muslim, a specifically Muslim government, so they left for Glendale.
Okay,
there's also large settlements of Arab Christians in, I think, Ohio.
Right.
This is probably worth saying that Christians are not the only guys facing persecution here. I mean, we're seeing this kind of religious cleansing, which is going on pretty much worldwide right now, as seeing the Baha'is kicked out of Iran. They're under terrible persecution in Iran. And in America, it's not just the Christians who are the new refugees. You're seeing some pre-Christian groups there also being kicked out of Iraq by the resurgent Islamists. So right around the world, you're seeing this trend of what had been centuries of cohabitation being replaced by tension and warfare effectively based on religion. And
right.
it's something which Rupert Short documents in his brilliant book, Christianophobia, which is striking about the fact he starts off with Christians, but then points out how right around the world you're seeing Hindus, Shiites, this kind of tension all around, and it's a very modern phenomenon.
Does that then, this brings me on to the next big issue, does that not then validate the argument that the Foreign Office has sometimes put out, that what's taking place over there is not the targeting of one particular group, but a broad humanitarian crisis, and that it's wrong to think about it in terms of Christians being the immediate targets of persecution?
Well, this is a real conundrum for the Foreign Office. I was at a seminar recently where Baroness Warsi, who's now a minister in the Foreign Office, was holding a discussion about this, what should we do? Now, she actually can speak out for the Christians because she's a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult, or rather the Christians in the cabinet believe it's difficult for them to say, look at this terrible Christian persecution. For a start, it's deeply unfashionable to actually refer to Christians as being under attack somewhere makes it sound as if you're a majority holding out for another majority. Of course, they're a persecuted minority, but it can't. Basically, David Cameron and his friends cannot be seen to be standing up for Christians. It's politically difficult to do on a domestic basis in Britain. Baroness Warsi is better able to do this, and she's being persuaded actually by the Jews. The former chief rabbi Lord Sacks has spoken very eloquently about this, drawing direct parallels between what's happening to Christians in the Middle East and what was happening to Jews in the middle of the last century. There was a brilliant House of Lords debate, which the Chief Rabbi closed by saying then that what he remembered, or what Jews remembered, was not the voices of their enemies, but the silence of their friends.
Mm. Right. Father, why do you think people are so uncomfortable about running to the defence of fellow Christians?
I hate to say this because it's the thing I always say. I blame Professor Dawkins and his friends. They have demonised Christianity in this country. Therefore, to stand up for Christianity is a deeply unfashionable thing to do. And therefore, nobody really wants to do it. And the boot is on the other foot. Christians have ruled the roost, it seems, for so long. Now they're being persecuted. Well, what goes around comes around.
So is the problem that people don't want to be, as Fraser said, seeming to be defending a majority faith
yes,
and the
absolutely.
Oppressors? But in a region where, of course, they're not the majority.
Absolutely. They are a minority, but some would say they are a privileged minority.
But the other argument they advance is that if Western governments go out to protect the Christians, that will make it even worse for them, because their enemies want to project them as somehow Western interlopers. Of course, Christianity is a Middle Eastern export. They way predate the Muslims. But the idea that they're somehow Western fifth columnists is something which is argued, with some plausibility here, I should add, that would just make it worse for them if it seems that Obama and Cameron...
But of course, that argument doesn't stop us from contemplating military intervention in Syria.
I would... I actually say the first step should be to give refugee status to those who come here. Right now they don't have it, and I think they do deserve it. There are lots of Christian refugees in Acton in London, for example, Iraqi Christians, who are being sent back to Iraq because it's not believed that they're under sufficient threat. I think the first thing that we can do is to open our doors to those who are in fear of our lives. I mean, the Swedes are doing it, the Germans are doing it. I don't see why Britain, which takes in so many people for a lot of other causes, shouldn't give sanctuary to those who, in the way that the Americans are doing right now.
Can you ever imagine a British government expressing solidarity with a Christian group?
I think that the atrocities we're witnessing are becoming so bad that the government will not be able to ignore it for that much longer. When this first started happening 2 or 3 years ago, Sarkozy saw it, but it wasn't that visible to those who wanted to ignore it. Now it's difficult to turn your face away from what's happening in Egypt to the Coptic Christians, what's happening in northern Pakistan, where there's still an Anglican bishop. I mean, there are so many humanitarian concerns now that I think it's becoming a mainstream issue.
Right.
And we'll have to grasp this nettle.
I suppose, Father, what I'm sort of getting at is that there's an obvious humanitarian reason why you would want to defend Christians, simply because they're human beings. But it seems historically strange to me that the West is in a situation now where it will not defend someone simply because they are Christian. There is no sense of brotherhood because we are Christians too.
Fraser's mentioned Sarkozy twice, and Sarkozy is just doing what the rulers of France did in the 18th century. And, of course, the other big unmentioned here is Putin. Putin is taking on the mantle of the Tsars as the defender of the Christians in the Middle East, as are the French. The French were always very much interested in Ottoman alliances. And, of course, the Russians, as we know, were very interested in the Middle East and interfering in the Ottoman Empire. The Tsar always posed as the protector of the Christians living in the Holy Lands and in Syria and so on, and in Anatolia, as did Napoleon III. And that's one of the reasons, and so it goes on, that was one of the reasons why the Crimean War broke out, as you know.
And yet the irony is that France is a secular state, aggressively so, and Russia has been through a period of communism and of war with its own church.
And yet people do revert to type, don't they? After all, it was only President Hollande who really wanted to intervene in Syria this time around. So that is interesting. Now, of course, this is to some extent bad news for the Christians, because President Putin is hardly a respectable sort of protector. And he's hardly the sort of person you want standing up for you, but, particularly as his motives are not particularly pure.
I think that Western governments have had difficulty, in a way the Russians haven't, in seeing how the dividing lines are being redrawn. We're so used to thinking about conflict as being something that happens between countries over basically national boundaries. The new conflicts of this young century are happening on ethnic and religious boundaries, and lives are being lost on a daily basis. Our foreign policy has not rebooted itself to take account of that fact. It will have to eventually, because this is obviously where the tensions of the future are coming, and the refugees will come here whether we want them or not.
But Vladimir Putin's foreign policy has rebooted to that effect.
Yes, because Putin has always been aware of the power of culture. I mean, remember, he's been fighting Muslim extremists in the Caucasus. I mean, this is a card which Putin, the most reptilian of world leaders, has been playing for some time. We're not used, because our foreign office is more bureaucratic. I actually do believe that Baroness Varsi, a Muslim, is our best single hope for bringing this to the government's attention.
Interesting. Yes. Final question. Father, are you comfortable with the use of the word martyrs?
Yes, I am. If you're killed for in odium of the faith, you are automatically a martyr, even if you're in a state of mortal sin. I can give you that as a fact, as a Catholic moral theologian. All those people who were killed simply because they were Christians in the Nairobi Mall are martyrs. They go straight to heaven. They are saints with God right now. Ditto the people who were killed in the church in Peshawar. They are martyrs. They were killed simply because they were Christians. Therefore, they have the baptism of blood. Even the ones who had not even been baptized, who were just in the church as catechumens. They are martyrs for the faith.
Father Alexander Lucy Smith and Fraser Nelson, thank you both very much. When you say the word Renaissance, you might think of Michelangelo, Petrarch, art, philosophy, humanism, beauty, and maybe even the dawning of the modern age. Not so, says a new book called The Ugly Renaissance by Dr. Alex Lee. Dr. Lee tells the story of an age of plagues, religious confrontation, corruption, violence, bigotry, and decadent popes with courts that resemble brothels. It's a startling rethink about a period that we've all come to comfortably think of as enlightened. So what was it really like, and where does our rosy impression of it come from? Alex, if we can start with a bit of your book that interested me, a scene in the Sistine Chapel, something which we all have a very fixed idea of its beauty and its meaning, but there's something there which is surprisingly ugly.
Of course, when we think about the Sistine Chapel ceiling, we're used to imagining these pictures of tremendous beauty showing the whole history of creation from God separating light from darkness right through to the birth of Christ and on the far wall of the Last Judgment. But quite close to the altar, hidden away in a little lunette, Michelangelo also included a portrait of a relatively little-known Old Testament figure, sitting on his haunches, dressed in loose flowing robes, and looking to all the world as if he's had the worst day of his life. He's had his eyes gouged out. And if that weren't enough, he's also wearing on his left arm a large yellow circle. The yellow circle was a sign which all Jews in Renaissance Italy had been forced to wear since about the 13th century. It was a sign of exclusion, of persecution, of intolerance. It pointed to the fact that a large number of Jews had contributed very significantly towards the growth of Renaissance culture and the emergence of humanism. For example, people like Marsilio Ficino and Giovanni Pico della Mirandola, the foremost humanists of the 15th century, had both learned Hebrew from a rabbi himself. And they had contributed extensively to the growth of medicine, for example, Aristotelian learning, and of course, economic functions as well. But on the other hand, the states of northern Italy had grown to foster forms of prejudice, which not only looked back to the violence and brutality of the Middle Ages, and we think of, for example, the expulsion of the Jews from England in the 12th, 13th centuries, the slaughter of the Jews in Worms as well, but also forward to new and ever more unpleasant forms of persecution as well. It was in the 16th century, for example, that the first ghetto in Europe was founded in Venice.
Right.
It was in Rome, not far from the Sistine Chapel, that Jews were forced to run almost naked through the streets of Rome while they were being prodded with spears and pelted with rotten fruit for the amusement of Romans during the Carnivale, along a street still known as the Race, Corso.
So I think it would be one thing to say simply that awful things happened during the Renaissance and that mm-hmm. it wasn't a period in which everyone subscribed to humanistic or enlightened values. But it seems to me what you're arguing in a broader sense is that it's a period as marked as much by continuity of attitudes and of values as much as it is a radical departure.
Well, in a sense, I think that is a useful way of thinking about it. It is quite common for us to perceive there to be a stark break between the medieval and the Renaissance, where the medieval is characterized by darkness and rottenness and huts made of dung and people eating donkeys, things like that. And the Renaissance, where it was always sunny, it was always wonderful, an age of high culture, improvement in standard of living, etc., etc. But what I've tried to show is not only was there a continuity of low morals, if you like, a continuity of social norms and social attitudes that were actually quite unpleasant by any standards, not just the standards of today, but also that it was really these nasty asides, the Renaissance, which provided the catalyst for and the context for the explosion of artistic innovation with which we commonly associate the period.
So there's actually a link between the depravity and also the artistic creation as well.
I think it would be misguided to try and separate the two. Is it meaningful in any age, you might ask, to attempt to look at, say, a novel, a poem, a book of any complexion, a work of philosophy, a work of art, in isolation from the artist's life and in isolation from the time in which the artist himself lived.
Is there a particular example from the Renaissance of one of those artists whose life might surprise us in its devilry and its misbehaviour?
Well, almost every artist you pick,
right,
or you could care to name, has something rather shameful in their background. Raphael, for example, never married, according to Vasari, because he was so obsessed with chasing girls left, right and centre. Fra Filippo Lippi was so addicted to lust that he had to be locked away in a cell by Cosimo de' Medici to prevent him chasing the young girl to the city. He actually escaped as well. But to show a link between these kind of unusual and unexpected personal habits and the character of the art of the period, I think it's quite useful to look at someone who isn't perhaps an A-list artist, somebody like Piero di Cosimo, many of whose works you can see in the National Gallery. As an artist, he's best known for fantasia, his works of fantasy, wild imagination, pictures that seem to burst with monsters and peculiar forms that look back to classical the art and mythology of classical antiquity and forward to the imaginings of the modern science fiction, if you like. But it's impossible to understand this without looking at his own life. He was possibly the most misanthropic man of the entire age.
Right.
He hated humanity. He was afraid of fire. He existed entirely on boiled eggs, which he would cook 50 at a time. But yet, and as a consequence, you see in his works a profound pessimism about the character of human civilization, about the idea of progress in human history, and a real belief in this strange, violent, unpleasant nature, this untamed nature of life itself, of nature, of the real world.
So are you arguing, and I know that it is a controversial point of view within the discipline of history of thought, that understanding the artist and their life better helps us understand their work?
Absolutely. I struggle to understand how you...
We can't study these texts in isolation. We can't see them as simply works that stand apart from the person who created them.
Well, I'm afraid I'm not one of these people who necessarily subscribes to the view of the author is dead. I'm of exactly the opposite viewpoint, saying that everything is conceived and composed in a very definite socio-cultural context.
Right.
And it can only be fully understood when it's placed back in that context.
Okay. So if we can also look at some of the artists and through understanding their life see them as historical figures, can we also do that for some of the bad people from the period, like Alexander VI, the Borgia popes? Can we look at them and by placing the context of their period, see them less as rogues and more as actually perfectly normal people who the people around them would have understood quite well?
Well, Alexander VI, the second of the Borgia popes, is actually a very brilliant example. The Borgias, you know, everyone's seen the TV series, or the many TV series, they look pretty ghastly. They are accused or have been accused for many hundreds of years of committing every sin in the book, really, from incest downwards. However, when you actually look at the evidence, first of all, they didn't do a lot of these things. There's no evidence of incest at all, for example. Cesare Borgia is accused of killing his brother Juan. That's almost nonsensical. It makes no sense of that. And there's a couple of other things that simply can't have happened, like the famous Banquet of the Chestnuts, for example, where 50 famous courtesans were reputed to have come to St. Peter's and for an enormous orgy with the Pope and his children. And we only have one source for this, Johann Burchard, and it's nonsense. But even those crimes of which they've been accused, for which there is evidence, are not only kind of understandable given their own position, but also not all that unusual.
Right.
So, let's take the case of Alexander VI being a lusty old devil. Well, yes, he was. Bottom line, he kept at least two mistresses openly. He acknowledged, in as full a way as he could, his children, his numerous children, and elevated them within the church. He elevated 10 of his kinsmen to the Sacred College of Cardinals.
Right.
Fine. Okay, today that looks pretty horrific. But this is entirely normal.
Yeah.
in terms of, you know, sexuality. Most Renaissance popes had relationships. Pope Pius II, he was thought to be one of the best Renaissance popes before he, when he was a cardinal, fathered a child in Scotland, for example, who he promptly abandoned. I think it was Sixtus IV, on a slightly different note, who permitted the College of Cardinals to commit sodomy during the summer.
Right.
I think that was so he could indulge it. Pope, I think it was Paul II or Paul III, I forget exactly which one it was, who was reputed to have died while being sodomized by a page boy.
Right, right.
The advancement of children was similarly very common.
So there's nothing necessarily about the Borgias which marks them out as very, very different.
Not at all.
A final question then. During this period, what was England like? Because the book inevitably covers a lot of European culture, but is there anything interesting happening in jolly old England?
Well, if
the answer's no, you can just say no. We won't be offended.
In this respect, I'm going to have to admit to my ignorance. But I'll say two things. If you take the period of the Renaissance, broadly conceived, that is between about 1300 and 1550, that's a period of tremendous change in English history. You've got the Hundred Years' War, the emergence of the Tudors, etc.
But all we do is kill each other.
Yeah,
we don't really stop to think.
Tim, I can't lie. I'm an Italian historian for a reason.
Yeah.
You do have a better quality of depravity in Renaissance Italy. There's no less violence. Italy is the age of the... So the Renaissance in Italy is the age of the mercenary general, for example, the psychopathic mercenary general who make any British commander, any British noble look like an amateur as far as violence and savagery is concerned.
Yeah.
But the point is that because I think there is such fluidity in the political world and in the social substructures of Renaissance Italy, you have a kind of motivation for the patronage of arts and the expansion of patronage, which prompts the invention of new forms of representation, new forms of material culture, and also new ways of representing and covering up some of the terrible faults we've discussed.
Okay, well, for a better class of pervert and murderer, I advise everyone to read The Ugly Renaissance by Alex Lee. Thank you very much, Alex.
Thank you, Tim.
For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.